Dzień dobry w kolejnym odcinku Radiowa Roza. Ten odcinek jest wyjątkowy.
Okay, so today we are interviewing, this will be a special episode because we're interviewing our guest from Germany who is researching viral resistance and who is a scientist from Germany.
Hello.
Hello.
How did you become interested in honeybees? Did you work also with other animals?
Actually, the first contact was through to my father. And he was always interested in bees, never had time to keep bees. But then a good friend of him, who was beekeeper before, one day came and gave him two hives. And then the bees were there. And I was 14, 15 years, something like this. And from that moment on, the bees catched me and I got interested. And anyhow, I have been grown up on a kind of farm, so a small farm. So I was in touch with nature and agriculture from the beginning. We had sheep, we had dogs, we had, what else? Horses.
Different animals.
Different animals. And later on, then I decided to study biology and agriculture. And part of this agriculture study was also practical work on the farm. So I came in touch with cattle and other animals. Yeah, that's my passion, let me say.
But as a researcher, you only researched bees, yeah? Or
yes. When it comes to serious research work, I mean, I studied agriculture then at the University of Bonn, and at that time, bees were just a hobby, but then I noticed there's a specialized institute for bee biology and pollination. And of course, I went there to visit all the courses. And that was my first step into the scientific approach. And yeah, it was fascinating for me. And then I started my PhD at that institute. And that was the first step in bee research. Yeah.
So this was before the Varroa invasion.
It was the time when Varroa step by step came into the country. So probably the introduction to Germany was in 75. So it was first detected in 78. And then it took about 10 years to spread everywhere. The region where I was grown up at that time had no Varroa. And so the very first years of my beekeeping was without. But then in Bonn region, we got the mite, I think, 82, 83. And so from the very beginning of the Varroa research activities in Germany, I was involved in this.
So in Poland, we had Varroa found in 1981. Mm-hmm. So this was just in close time between this.
Yeah. Some years later, but
yeah. Did Varroa came to Germany from Poland or from different direction?
No, it probably came from Southeast Europe with imports, which were done for scientific reasons.
Oh,
so as far as we know, it was first brought to an institute close to Frankfurt and spread from there.
Okay. Yeah. So do you know which country was it from? Because you said imported. So
yeah,
so
probably Romania.
So what treatments, what active substances have you used in the beginning? Because in Poland, at least in some parts, experimented with some drugs that were not fully maybe researched and not fully known to science. Yeah, this was just experiments. So what were the substances in Germany?
I mean, there was panic in the beginning. That's very clear. And what was established at the market was Folbex, because that was used at the time to fight Fraenkel mites. And then people noticed, well, there is some efficacy against Varroa as well. So actually, Folbex was the first substance used. And later on, we saw the huge problems which it provoked with residues and so on. And then very soon we got pericine, Kumafos. And parallel to this, in the early stage, already formic acid. So it was early detected that these organic acids might be used. So it developed step by step. And then later on, we got this bivarol, flumitrine. So this kind of substances. We never had Apistan registered in Germany, But beekeepers started to use apistan because they know from countries abroad that it acts. And yeah, and then we got resistance against flumitrine and fluvalinate as the active substance in apistan. So the story. At the end, all the substances which are known in the world probably were used sometime in Germany.
So not everything was perfect, as you said, and there was some resistance to the substances, yeah?
Yeah, this came then in the early 90s, if I remember well. So 10 years after the start of regular systemic treatment, yeah. But before we saw the negative effects, I mean, all those drugs have some effect on the bees. Mm-hmm. It's not just helpful for the bees. And then also about the time, late 80s, early 90s, we got the first samples where we saw, well, there's residues in our bee products. It was first detected in honey, but you know, when people started then to investigate where is it coming from, it was noticed that wax is the main problem. Yeah, wax solutes very well these.
Which substances were in wax? Each
Folbex was a catastrophe.
Okay.
Yeah, Folbex were really high contents, but also Kumafos is risky to provoke high wax residues. And then it's always a balance. I mean, those synthetic drugs are very lipophile, so they solute very well in wax. And there's just a very low solubility in water. And that means the content in honey will be much lower. But we reached residual levels in wax, which were high enough that whenever you harvest honey from combs, which were built on such foundation, you get some residues in the honey as well.
So these substances were going from the wax to the honey.
Yeah.
Okay, not from the treatments to the hive, but from the wax to the honey, from the foundations.
No, we are the wax. I mean, the beekeepers use it for treatment. Yeah. You have high residues in the wax. The wax is recycled because the beekeepers produce their own foundation from the wax, which is on the market. And then with the foundation, you already buy substances which later on turn up as residues in the honey which you harvest. So that was the situation in the early 90s. So
I was just wondering if beekeepers were using these substances while bees were gathering honey. So how they shouldn't have been using, yeah? Just asking. If it was from the wax.
Okay. I mean, you had single cases like this with extremely high residue levels then, but I think most of the beekeepers used such drugs according to the labels. And still, we had this measurable residues in the honey and, of course, in pollen and propolis and all this. So,
Do you have in Germany problem with beekeepers that are not using those drugs according to procedures? So they are not using according to labels, because in Poland, for sure, there are some beekeepers like this. I have no idea how much percentage is that, but for sure there are.
It may be similar in Germany. I mean, there's always high interest of beekeepers if they hear rumors about something new which acts very well, and then they find channels to get such substances. In general, I think most beekeepers keep the rules nowadays, and it's much more relaxed now because we got this different acids and thymol and such more natural-like substances which are officially registered and can be used. So it's not a huge problem. Mm-hmm. But sometimes you find beekeepers who use drugs which are not registered. Yeah.
As far as I know, I'm not sure about it, but as far as I know, I've heard that in Polish wax, coming from Polish apiaries, there were found substances that are not allowed to use in Poland. So it's either importing wax from countries that allow these substances, or beekeepers are using those substances which they shouldn't be. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's the same situation in Germany. We sometimes get residues with the wax which is imported, and So at the end, you get the complete mixture. And we had the discussion this morning in the plenary session about pesticides in general, and wax is always an important bridge. So wax can salute everything. And if you don't know the source of wax, which you bring into your hives, you always have a high risk to bring in substances which you won't lose afterwards anymore.
That's why I sometimes wonder why beekeepers are not using foundationless frames, just allow bees to build their own combs. I'm not using foundation at all. For 10 years, I haven't used any one.
Okay, this is one option, of course. You're right. Still, there are good arguments in commercial beekeeping to use foundation. But then you have the option still to check the wax before you buy it. And you should go for certificates that it's free of residues. That's what we learned.
Ja z kolei robię tak połowicznie, czyli stosuję.
He said that he's using the halfway method because he's using only the every second frame with foundation, and this foundation is only from his own apiary. So it's another way of.
Yeah, sure. There.
Yeah, there are many methods.
There are many ways available.
So we know from scientific meta-analysis that and review studies that there are more than 20 resistant bee populations in Europe, and some of those populations come from natural selected bees, and some come from breeding from different beekeepers. And have you studied any of those populations? And what can you tell us about those populations of resistant bees in Europe? For sure, they are in France. For sure, from what we've heard, there are some selected in Germany. There are some in Scandinavia. There are some in England. So have you researched any of those?
Yeah, I was always interested in such cases, and I was involved in some of the experiments. Personally, I got experience with bees from John Kefus, for example, and from this Avignon population, and also got some Gotland bees, and I was involved in the study with Norwegian bees. So, very interesting aspect, and looking backward, I would like to say we learned quite a lot from this kind of studies with different genotypes. And one crucial study was done under the roof of COLOS. So this is the International Cooperation of Bee Scientists. And there's one group, RNSBB, Research Network for Sustainable Bee Breeding. It's a very strong group, and we cooperate since 20 years. And so we organized an European-wide exchange of different potential resistant stock and checked the interaction between genotypes and environment. Mm-hmm. And that was a very clear outcome. We found some populations which do very well without treatment in certain locations and a certain management concept. And the same bees completely fail when you bring them in other regions and with other management. So, for example, in this international experiment, one test apiary was at our institute in Kirchheim in Germany. And at that time, we had five or six lines. One of them was this resistant bees from south of France, from Avignon, got them from John Kefus, from Yves LeConte at that time. And we had big problems with just bees, and they tend to swarm. So it's completely different management. They were not well adapted to our climate and annual development. And at the end, those bees had extremely high infestation levels.
Oh.
So it was just the opposite. And at the same time, sister queens, similar mated than the one which we got, were tested in Avignon, and they were doing well there. So it's really, and you can read this all published stuff, and it is not the only study, but there were several like this in the last few years, which clearly show we have a very strong interaction of genotype and environmental factors.
Yes.
So the conclusion for beekeepers is your bees have to be well adapted to your climate, to your honey flow, to the annual situation, and also including the beekeeping methods and the way how beekeepers keep their bees. So it all belongs together, and bees can very well adapt to local conditions if you select them on a local level.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I've heard that in Poland we have, I think, most imported foreign, let's call them queens, from different countries. Most in European Union. So we are like beekeepers call it in Polish like a zoo. We have like a zoo with all the mixtures. So now we have bees from Turkey, from North Africa, from all the Europe. It's just crazy.
It can't be a good solution on a long term. So if you want to improve your stock, you have to select it on a local base. Mm-hmm. Under your environmental conditions, with the pests and diseases which are present in your spot. And so with all these important environmental factors, you have to select on a local spot, and then you can really improve if you have a continuous selection work done. I mean, nevertheless, it could make sense for a breeder to import one or the other stock to be tested under your conditions, and sometimes crossings make sense. So this is part of a good selection program.
Yeah, but if they are not controlled at all and everybody does them, then it's this mixture is like a bomb. Yeah, it must explode.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. So the queens which go to the field should be well approved under the given conditions.
And what are the role of biotechnical methods in all this way of keeping bees, selecting bees?
Way to sustainability.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe we have to define biotechnical methods. And the way how I understand it is that, first of all, you try to better understand the biology of bees, and from this develop then management concepts which are coming close to natural development curves. So one core point is, under natural conditions, colonies usually go to swarm somewhere in the top of the season. That's why bees collect a lot of honey and a lot of pollen and have this strong growth, so that they get a chance to split and to propagate. And of course, beekeeping develop methods to prevent swarming, because we want to have stronger colonies and thereby getting more honey. And that makes sense from the economical point of view. But what we have overlooked for a long period is that the swarming is not only propagation of colonies, but it's extremely important regarding the bee pathology, because the swarming means you have a seasonal interruption of the brood activity. And this is for all kind of brood diseases, very critical thing. I mean, take American foul brood as one of the most infectious bee diseases which we know. I mean, it's really a huge risk. And nowadays, there is a good biotechnical way to heal colonies from American foul brood just by making artificial swarms. Yeah. You can take the bees, put them in an empty box, let them build their new combs, and the colony can be healed. So that shows the full potential of swarming with regard to all the bee diseases. And now we suffer from varroa. But if you have a deeper look on what is going on there, we don't have a varroa problem. We have a problem with a continuous brood season from early spring to late autumn, and in future maybe also during winter, because we get a milder climate. So this is an unnatural situation. And this is biotechnic for me, that once I understand this biology, then I have to say, well, and if I am the beekeeper who make the management concept, then I have to learn from nature. And if bees need seasonal brood interruption to stay healthy, then it's my obligation as a responsible beekeeper how I can implement this in my management concept. So at the end, I can't say if it's treatment against, or if is it just helping the bees to keep their natural demands, you see? And so this is the first thing in biotechnical methods, mm-hmm. that we want to come to a more simple, more nature-like management, which strengthens the vitality and the resilience, as we tend to say nowadays, of our honeybees.
Well, some beekeepers, if I may interrupt, I even had a conversation today, just believe that there is almost no such thing as resistant by traits, that those wild living, feral living populations, they are just swarming, and because of that, they can survive. But we know that it's much more than only swarming. Yeah, it helps, but it's not enough. I try myself some method called expansion model beekeeping. I don't know if you know it. It's just taking artificial swarms, and then when there are queen cells, just divide the rest. So you make lots of nooks from lots of splits from a colony, and this in this first time gives you some advantage in the race with varroa, yeah, because you make this colony split, yeah. But I see by my example that it's not enough to keep them surviving.
That's right.
It helps, and it may help for 2 seasons, for example, yeah. But varroa will catch up if the bees won't have some resistant traits, yeah.
Absolutely right. We have the same experience, and this leads to the second aspect why we need biological or biotechnical methods. I mean, what happens in nature? Swarming helps in the first step, but it's not the final solution. Bees will adapt their behaviors, and also the mites and viruses will adapt to the environmental situation. So it, in a natural system, you have a continuous selection and balancing of the situation.
And they are all changing, evolving. It's not only the bees, but
it's, also it's going hand in hand.
Yeah, there were many researches about changing varroa genotype, for example. Yeah, so pathogens can change, and they can change virulence. Yeah, in plus or in minus, and varroa can change. So it's the whole system that is evolving. Yeah,
not exactly. Only the bees. I mean, to be precise, we don't find much genetic variation within varroa because they usually build clones, more or less.
I think Gotland experiment proved that there were some changes in varroa, even if it's small differences, but there were some genetic changes after 10 years or so without treatments on Gotland. So it will change. Yeah,
yeah, but probably what is much more important in this complex, which we call varroosis, it's the mite combined with the secondary infections. So it's the variability in the virus infections. And this is what we saw the last few years in many studies, that the virus species vary, and viruses are genetically very flexible, so they can easily adapt. We saw this with Corona, how quickly you have new strains, and the same happened with the viruses and the bees. And the virus population will adapt to the living condition of the colonies. So, however, at the end, it's really a complex system, and it always interacts. And this is what we clearly see now. If we have this intensive chemical treatment against varroa, we will never have a chance to escape this high varroa pressure. Because with this system, we really provoke selection for very aggressive varroa virus combinations, and we prevent that bees which do slightly better have a chance to dominate in the mating process. And this is the second aspect why we urgently need to come to biological, biotechnical methods. If we help bees in the first step by such an artificial brood interruption in summer, so copying the natural swarming process, then we have a higher chance to winter colonies without a winter treatment. And the consequences, when it comes to next year's mating period, you have colonies which remained nearly 1 year without treatment. And there are differences in the bee population, which is present right now in your country. You have susceptible stock, and you have stock which show at least some resistance. At the moment where you let them develop 1 year without affecting the mite population by beekeepers' activities, then you will have higher and less infested colonies. And this has already been shown. Varroa has a tremendous effect on the rearing of drones and on the vitality of drones. And if there's a varroa mite in a drone poop cell, this drone will never have a chance to mate a queen in the open mating process. So nature has foreseen the situation, let me say. It's a bit pathetic maybe, but this is the reality. So we have a perfect mating system in honeybees.
Przejdziemy do tego w następnym...
Za chwilę. Kuba said that we will ask you about this open mating things. Yeah, but I was, because the system that you proposed today on your lecture, and now you're talking about it. So when you make the situation in the hive that you actually, for the winter, leave some pressure of mites, but it's not needed, let's call it, for the winter. It's needed, as you said, for the next spring and for this mating season. And do you think that this could be just the selection itself without even selecting the queens? Just leaving this system and let those that can't cope just let's call them die out or without propagation. Just leaving the pressure of drones to be the only system of selection. Would you say it's enough, or you have to do some selection of colonies and propagate the queens as well?
I would recommend to do both. I mean, there clearly is this natural selection pressure on, especially on the drone population. So it would help on the long term. It's crucial to get resistant stock established in the whole population. Mm-hmm. But you are much more effective if you select also on the queen side. And this is what breeders can do now. In the meantime, we understand quite well the mechanisms of resistance in honeybees. And it's mainly this VSH trait. So there are some bees, it's some individuals in the hive, which are really capable to detect varroa-infested cells. And then those bees who are capable to smell this, because it's a question of smell, not from the mites, but from the affected brood cell, they communicate, the pupae can say, well, here something is wrong in my cell. And then those bees should be ready to open the cell to inspect it, and they recap it, or they even completely remove it. And this is what we call VSH, varroa sensitive hygiene. And this is probably the most important resistance behavior towards varroa and maybe also other mites which invade.
So you're the one that is not, let's call it, combining the trait of recapping and VSH. You think it's the one trait, yeah? One trait, recapping.
Yeah, yeah.
Because some scientists say that the mechanism of, let's call them, smelling varroa inside the cell is similar in both, but recapping is just opening and closing, and VSH is taking out. So... But it's similar with smelling, yeah?
So it's closely correlated. And the initial point is the smell and bees who detect it and react. And what happens then is a very dynamic system. I mean, what we have seen, we had one student, he was expected to follow artificially infested cells built at a glass wall, so in an observation hive. And I think the maximum he found was one cell, which was infested and then opened 17 times and closed again on the way from the original ceiling of the brood cell at the ninth day after egg laying.
So it's twice a day, yeah? Something like twice a day.
About this. I mean, it's an extreme and it's maybe an artificial situation, but it opened our eyes because we understood, well, it's not that bees seal the cell and then don't touch it until the young bee emerges. But there's really communication and a certain dynamic. And in this sense, what was observed with infrared observation of the whole process, certain bees start to open and then they leave and go to the next cell, which has to be detected. And other bees follow and they do the opening then. But at the same time, you find bees, they have nothing better to do than, oh, there is a hole in the ceiling. I have to close it very soon. So this is the dynamic in the hive. And in that sense, the initiation of VSH is just the same as recapping. And if we go for recapping, then in tendency, we find colonies which are capable for VSH. It's not exactly the same. And the colleagues in Baton Rouge, they sometimes reported about mat recappers. So colonies which open all the cells and recap and doesn't interfere too much with varroa. So they're, it's more complex. But it's the same track, let me say. And recapping and VSH are extremely interesting. Yeah.
Okay, so I hope to translate it. Yeah, because from what you said, biotechnical methods alone won't be enough to progress in the selection. You have to do systemic actions on other directions as well. So you have to do the selection itself. So only doing the biotechnical methods will control varroa population, but it won't be doing any selection in the future. Or will it select this complex system of organism?
I would like to make sure that you understand the idea. And you see, the critical point is we have to come to a situation where we don't need winter treatment, at least not as a routine. There may be urgent cases where you need a winter treatment, but the standard should be we find management concept which ensures that we get healthy winter bees in August, September. Healthy winter bees means no varroa, no high virus loads, good pollen and protein supply, and all this. So this must be the main care of the beekeeper. Once they reach this point, and brood interruption somewhere in June, July, is an extremely effective step to reach this final goal, that you have excellent winter bees in the hive. Then you start to forget about winter treatment. There is a huge misunderstanding of the winter treatment. Many beekeepers still believe I have to kill the mites in the winter because they harm the bees. No, it's not like this. Mm-hmm. The winter treatment harms the bees. Oxalic acid is really a stress for the colony. It's much better if you can avoid it. And the harm which those mites did to bees already happened in August, September, because if you kill many mites in December, they have been probably in the brood in August, September, maybe October. So this is a critical period. And still we learned that we need a winter treatment because with our traditional chemical methods, we can't treat colonies in time before the next winter bee production. So we have to harvest all the honey first, and then beekeepers start to treat against varroa maybe end of July, August, sometimes even
September.
September. And this is much too late. This is much too late. And then you have high virus loads on the bees. Even if you kill the mites with formic acid or whatever, you still have the viruses.
So we have the worst situation.
Yeah. We really are with our backs at the wall. Yeah. It's already too late. And with these biotechnical methods, you get the chance to treat in a natural way in time. And then you have healthy winter bees, and then you don't care about the mites on the bees in winter. And you are not worried if there are 500 mites in the hive right now, because you know, next year in June, I come with my brood interruption again, and then I can easily catch all the mites. Until that time, the bees have a stronger development with this huge increase in brood production in early spring. They run away, the mite infestation. No problem. nobody has problems in April, May, June with mites. And then you come again. So don't worry. You lose the stress. And at the moment, beekeepers are always in stress.
Well, they are almost always on the lectures about varroa. They are told that they should be treating until there is very, very little amount of mites for the winter. Sometimes it's even said that for winter, you have to have zero mites.
Yeah. So maybe the solution is we have to make a revolution in the education.
Education is extremely important, but it's not only about the knowledge and education. It's very much about the motivation.
Yeah. The state of mind of bees, if they're nervous.
Experiences, I give training courses to beekeepers in 30 years, and I give many lectures, and I explain this. And what I learned, you need to be patient and you need to repeat things and to explain it again. And then
after 3 decades, you convince 2 people.
You see some movement. And this is not because the beekeepers are bad people. This is normal human behavior. Once you are used to something, you think this is normal and it should go on like this. If we are used to our cars driven with petrol and CO2 exhaustion, we think this is normal.
Yeah.
And all the scientists tell us we have urgently to change our CO2 footprint. But nobody reacts because my neighbors, everybody, do the same. So why should I react? This is just an example, but this is human psychology. Yeah. And the same is with beekeepers.
Yeah.
I mean, we got used to these chemical treatments and we think it's normal. And we learned that other beekeepers also suffer from 10, 15, 20, and sometimes even higher colony losses in winter. This is not normal.
You know, this is normal for most people maybe, but almost always you have in society some people that they are non-conformist or revolutionary mind like us.
I don't know about you, so that's your decision, but we know this from all these human systems.
Yeah.
I mean, you have some people who really develop new ideas and who take the full risk. And then you have what is called early inventors. So people who read and who study and are ready to test new things. And then you have the early followers. And we talk about 1% maybe with these early inventors. And then we have maybe up to 10% early followers. And that's where we are standing right now with biotechnical methods. Many beekeepers catch this up and they try. And once they did it, then very soon they are convinced. And then it can be a question of just some years. And then 90% of the beekeepers who are just followers who do what they ever did come into move because
biotechnical method is kind of catch of the beekeepers to convince to slowly convince them. Yes.
Yeah, it's something you have to learn and you have to see and you wait that people who try it fail, and then after some years, if they have stronger hives and less winter losses and less expenses and less residues, then you say, well, maybe I should silently try the same. That's the way. So that's normal. Let's take it.
This is a political strategy.
Yeah, in a way. No, it's just reality. I mean, such things need time. And still we have many institutes and we have many companies who say, well, you have to treat and take this new drug. And beekeepers are still waiting for the perfect drug, which make no residues, is highly effective, is cheap and whatever. So that will never be the solution, but that's where we are standing. And in that sense, I think we are still on a good way and we can improve European beekeeping.
Could you tell us more about ProVir 2033 project?
Oh, yes, that's interesting. And this is exactly the same subject. So in Germany, spring last year, we had a first meeting, which was organized by institutes and the beekeeping organizations, which we have in Germany together, with the idea, if we share our knowledge, and if we improve our selection methods, then we should have a chance to get German beekeeping free of the use of therapeutics within the next 10 years. And this is where this 2033 is coming from. It's 10 years after the initial start of this project. And the new thing is that here beekeepers from different organizations come together. So it's not only the German Beekeeper Association, but the professional beekeepers are involved. And we have these different breeder groups. So we have a strong Carnica breeding, of course, in Germany with Arbeitsgemeinschaft Toleranzzucht as a breeder association. But then we have a strong group of Buckfast breeders who do a good job. We also have mellifera breeders. And there's sometimes competition between those groups. Everybody thinks I have the best bee and I have the best concept. And here people meet and say, well, we have a common idea. We have a common challenge. And if we cooperate, we can help each other. And the point is exactly what we discussed before. It needs good selection. And this is done by the breeders, but it's a minority. It's less than 1% of the beekeepers. Really.
Yeah, but they produce queens for.
They produce queens and they can select on VSH, for example. So we have some breeders who really did an excellent job in this way. So there's some very good breeding stock available right now. And then it comes to the majority of beekeepers. And if we want to spread resistant stock in the wider population, then we need a change in the management procedures of the wider beekeeper community. So these are the two parts which we have to bring together. Good selection, appropriate propagation of selected stock, and then the majority of beekeepers which profit from the selection work of the breeders, but at the same time change the management concept. So, and this is where we need the biotechnical methods. They have to come to a colony management, which can easily go without winter treatment. We need healthy bees in August, not in January. And if we really reach this point, and there's a good dynamic, I'm not a prophet. I'm not sure if we succeed with this because it's always difficult. It's mainly a social project to bring together all those people, to convince them, to teach them, to help them, and all the practical challenges. It's a huge task, but we have the chance. It's not about the biology and it's not about the technology. We know how to select. We know there are resistant stock. We know how to use these biotechnical methods. So everything is there. It's just to combine it in a sensible way and to convince the people. So it's just this psychological, sociological maybe project.
The most difficult part. Biology.
Maybe this is the most. This is the most difficult organism in this system.
Absolutely, the humans are the challenge.
Maybe we should talk with the
human selection.
with scientists from sociology too.
Yeah, yeah, they are most welcome to help in this process. Yeah, most welcome. And yeah, we will see it. Anyhow, it's fascinating because you come together with so many different people and you have great discussions. And we are on the way with this Varroa 23 initiative. So we have regular meetings. In the meantime, we have several working groups. So there's a working group for breeding. There's a working group for biotechnical methods. And many beekeepers are involved, and so there is a growing dynamic in this field. And so I'm still optimistic. You see, it personally, in my active research period at the institute, so the last 30-35 years, I invested most of my energy in breeding and selection and on improvement of management concepts. And here both things come together. And when I retired 2 years ago, I said, well, now I have the freedom to take the essence of 35 years of research bring it together. And I would really like to see in my lifetime that things change in practical beekeeping.
Yes, it's nice. I've read interview with you in which you emphasized with different role and potential of commercial and hobby beekeeping. Could you say why?
Yeah, I mean, of course, they have different challenges. I mean, professional beekeepers have to be efficient. They have to harvest honey with less work input. They have to run high colony numbers, and that has some advantages and some disadvantages. So experienced people who know very well how to handle bees and who help us to simplify the methods. At the end, professional beekeepers depend on very simple, quick, easy methods. And this is good because what we are looking for is a more simple beekeeping, resistant stock, which needs less care but on the beekeeper side. And so it's good to have those people on board. And at the same time, smaller beekeepers have more time to record things, to observe things. When it comes to the breeding activity, for example, most of our active breeders keep about 30, 40, 50 hives. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, I'm myself a registered breeder. So I have at the moment 12 performance test colonies on my apiary, and everything is recorded there. Infestation development, bee population development, gentleness, swarming tendency, and even SMR and recapping and pin test and all those things. I mean, it's extremely fascinating work because you better understand your bees, but it's a lot of work. I couldn't do this if I would depend on the income from my apiary. I can do it because I'm a fascinated hobby beekeeper. Yeah. And people like this do the main selection work in the German population now. It's people with 30, 40, 50 hives. So, and therefore we have this capacity of people who volunteer in all this data collection and testing of bees. And both go very well hand in hand. And then of course, hobby beekeepers, they have higher freedom. They don't depend so much on this extremely high honey yields. If they say, I want to have some bees in my garden, they should pollinate, and I love to go there and follow their activity, then it's fine. It's fine. Excellent. They can do with some hives in their garden. And so at the end, I think it's really positive that we have both aspects, because both are relevant and both are realistic, and one can learn from the other.
And what do you think about treatment-free beekeeping? I mean normal beekeeping, but just without varroa treatment, as a way of progressing in the selection of bees that can survive without beekeepers' interventions and cope with the varroa mite by themselves. Mm.
You see, the point is we don't keep our bees in closed stall buildings. We can't close the door and say, well, what happens inside is an isolated process. No, bees live in the open. They harvest in several kilometers range. And when it comes to the exchange of varroa mites and diseases, we talk about 3, 4, 5 kilometers interaction with other colonies. So if you find a place in Poland where you have a 10 kilometer radius, no other bees, you're most welcome to run such a non-treatment experiment. We had some like this in different European parts. We discussed already about the Gotland experiment, which was one in this range. We did similar things on the island of Unije in Croatia. Part of the work done by John Kefus and Yves Leconte is in a similar direction. So it could make sense, but it depends on these isolated areas.
In Poland, we don't have such a place.
So forget about this non-treatment. No, it makes no sense. And this is stupid consequence, because we discuss now on the value of resistance. Some, especially beginner beekeepers, think, well, if I don't do anything, I help the population to survive. It's just the opposite. I mean, if we do nothing and colonies collapse, the other colonies around have a bigger problem. So for me, it's not a sensible way. It's scientifically interesting, but it's not a solution to the recent situation. No, what we really need is a better beekeeping, which helps to get healthy winter bees, as I explained with the need for biotechnical treatments. And once we have reached this point and we don't have winter treatment anymore, so we get a stronger natural selection effect on Varroa resistance in the population, and that's a way out. Yeah. And right now, I can run bees without chemical treatments. So every beginner should know, if you use the right management concept, you can immediately start without any drugs. I'm doing this on my private stock since about 10 years. So you see, you can immediately start to go without any therapeutics if you know the right way to use these biotechnical methods. And so even now, beekeepers who are interested in this direction can do this independently from the neighbor beekeepers. So they don't put any risk on their neighbors. It's opposite. Beekeepers who are not capable to keep the mite levels under certain thresholds right in time. So that means have low infestation pressure in the beginning of the winter bee rearing period, end of July, beginning of, those are the ones who make the problem. And it's all chemical beekeepers who have this problem, who come too late and who use ineffective measures. So that's a problem.
If I may, because I try to do beekeeping like this, and I fully understand this point, but the issue is, like, I always try to see different points of view. And my point of view in this dilemma, let's call it, it's that when I first started to try to keep bees without treatments, this was 10 years ago. And the first year I used powdered sugar method. So I tried to take down some, I mean, not measuring the varroa population, but let's call it as a treatment. I'm not saying it's efficient. It's not, but I thought I will help bees by using this powdered sugar method, so the mites will fall off. Yeah. And I've used it once, but the bees then died the first year I stopped treatments. All of my colonies died. It was 23 colonies, but it wasn't like I was the only, let's call it, island that lost the bees. All the beekeepers that treated bees that year in my neighborhood lost like 70% of bees, even though they treated. And one of the association, which is not my association, but the neighboring association, lost 90%. 90% of bees collapsed this year. So, you know, it was, of course, let's call it regional problem. It wasn't like this in all Poland. Yeah, it was in our neighborhood. But then I saw that the issue is not only if I'm treating or not, but the issue is that even treated bees die. So, you know, this year, for example, last year was a very bad year, and we had like hunger all year. I first time in my life I had to feed bees in May, because, you know, normally in May it's like the honey is like everywhere, and I had to feed bees in May even, and I had to feed bees all the season. And I lost almost all my apiary again this year. But my association, that are not only, you know, close to me, that it wasn't my mites that killed all of those bees, they lost 50% again, 50. So it's little less than 10 years ago, but it was still 50% even they treated. So, you know, for me, I see it as more complicated thing than just spreading the mites, because, you know, we all spread the mites, whether we treat or not. And I see that many of my colonies, I mean, I don't take measurements, but I see sometimes that some colonies have large amounts of mites, and some colonies are, well, for sure they have them. Yeah, I have no idea how many do they have, but I don't see the problems in them. Yeah, so I'm saying that, you know, after a few years, even if your colonies die, they most of time die late December, January. Mm-hmm. So they are, most of the mites are not spread, even if they die off. So I wouldn't say it's that much a problem, but this is my point of view. Yeah. I'm not saying it's objective. It's subjective. This is my opinion. Yeah. But I see it as more complicated issue than just spreading the mites by one person.
Yeah. You are at least partly right. I mean, it's very clear survival of colonies is multifactorial. Nutrition plays an important role. Climate plays an important role. Among this, varroa and the viruses going with varroa are probably one of the main factors. So at the end, it comes all together. And even if you have varroa perfectly under control, you will not in any year and any location prevent colony losses. So this is clear. And we had colony losses before we got varroa, and we will have them in future as well. So this is surely true. But it's also true there are certain thresholds regarding varroa infestation levels. And we don't discuss now if it's 8% or 10 or 15%, but somewhere around these values of infested brood cells results in emerging bees where this 90 or 85% of healthy bees can no longer compensate the loss. So there is some potential of colonies to compensate. But the trees are not growing to the sky, as we say in German. So there are certain biological limits. And at the moment where you exceed those limits, you will lose hives. It makes no sense. It really makes no sense. So it's more important to see which colonies can remain infestation levels over a longer period below the thresholds. Mm. And what can I do as a beekeeper with my management, with the whole system to help colonies in keeping low these infestation levels? I think that's a way. Yeah.
I must say that I agree with Ralf because I was treatment-free beekeeper with Bart. I started maybe the same time like Bartek, and I was a treatment-free beekeeper too, but after a few years, I changed my mind. I changed my view. And it was, we have a few difficult conversations.
Mm. Yeah, there was lots of discussions about it.
Yeah, so for now, I treat only one time per year my bees. And I don't change my queens. Mm. I have only local bees, you know. I don't change my bees for now, maybe 10 years.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, there are several interesting aspects. First, if we would have a completely natural system, then the colony losses would lead to a reduced colony density. And with the reduced colony density, you reduce the risk that one colony infects the other and so on. And then you have completely different dynamics in the spread of varroa and diseases. And then resistance can more quickly establish. And then the population can slowly grow again once it reached a higher resistance level. So there will be this balance between honeybee density and the pressure by pathogens and pests. So that's a natural situation. But we don't have the natural situation. Yeah. We discussed before, we have a beekeeping situation. Yeah. And the first point is we have apiaries. And it's not one colony as in nature, but it's 10, it's 20, sometimes it's 50 colonies in a place.
Trends in evolution will be different in that situation,
yeah.
Yes?
Absolutely.
Yeah, we agree on this.
And therefore, we have to be realistic. I mean, at least for me, it's very clear. I'm speaking here as a beekeeper. That means it's part of an agricultural use of animals. Yeah. Yeah. I'm working with bees in an agricultural system. And there's some economic interest behind, and there's certain management methods. And this is my starting point, and I want to have a...
Well, you see, my problem is, like, because, you know, I've for many years I've heard everything about me, about this topic, yeah? That I'm barbaric and so on. I've heard everything, yeah?
I am a traitor, maybe, from your point of view.
No. Anyway, so, you know, what I have problem with is, like, everybody is doing many things that are not solving the problem, like importing queens from Turkey, importing queens from Africa, doing the treatments like, you know, how people do, yeah? 5 times a year or 6 times a year, or doing 3 winter treatments because first is in November, the other is in December, the other is in February, and so on and so on. So in this system, as I agree with you, it's agricultural system and everybody is doing, you know, whatever he thinks is the best for his purposes, yeah? Whether it's just, you know, being with animals or whether it's earning money, yeah? Mm-hmm. Everybody has his or her purposes, yeah? And, you know, within this system, people are doing many things that are completely not sustainable, completely. Like, you know, this importation of queens is like crazy thing, yeah? This unreasonable treatments, it's absolutely crazy as well. You know, but then there is this one apiary, and this guy is barbaric, yeah, because he doesn't treat and he wants his bees to be healthy, maybe not in the best system, yeah, but you know,
or maybe not in the great rational way, maybe.
Yeah, maybe I'm not saying, yeah, what I have in my apiary is sometimes really big losses, and I'm fully aware that about the risk that you know that it may cause to other apiaries, but even if other apiaries are doing the treatments, they still may cause the same or even greater danger for others because of not doing reasonable things, yeah? Because of importing foreign genetics, because of making the virus loads more viral and more aggressive, yeah? Because of these constant treatments and so on. So, you know, I'm more than sure that if beekeepers were doing sustainable beekeeping, Vera problem would be solved in maximum 15 years. But everybody would have to do it, yeah? And almost nobody does it, yeah?
Do you agree with him?
Yeah, I agree that the main goal should be to come to sustainable solutions.
And I mean 15 years.
Yeah, as we discussed before.
They want to do it in 10. Yes.
But a different method.
10 years is realistic if really the beekeepers understand them as a beekeeper family, which have to act in a common direction. So that's the point, and that leaves it open. I mean, I come here as a scientist. Sorry, I don't follow certain philosophic ideas, but I clearly see there's biological context behind. So we have these thresholds, we have this population dynamic, and all those things are studied. We know the resistance rates, and we know the development of viruses, and we can use all this reliable information to make a better system, and better means sustainable. Yeah. More natural-like. So in this sense, I think we agree.
Yeah.
We can agree in mostly point of view, I think.
I think 99% we agree. Yeah.
Oh, that's a high level. I'm not used to that.
I would say that it's very high. Yeah? I would say that it's very high. We may value the different things more or less, but I think I agree with it.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, there's one extremely important point, maybe not so easy to understand in the first moment, but I would like to introduce this here. The difference between horizontal and vertical pest transmission or parasite transmission. So what is horizontal? What is vertical? Horizontal means if the spread of parasites, varroa in our case, is mainly going from one colony to the neighbor colony or to the neighbor apiary. So within the same generation, you can spread. The opposite is vertical. Vertical means the only way for the parasite to survive is to stay with his original host. And if the colony splits, part of the parasites go with the daughter colony to the next generation and from those to the over next generation. But it's always within the line of one hive. And this is known in the whole parasitology. It makes a complete difference regarding the development of the parasites. If you have a horizontal spread, the most aggressive parasites are the winners, because whenever they kill their host, they have excellent chances to survive in neighbor colonies. So the one which propagates quickest.
If from the human world, is a good example is Wszechliczna
rabies.
Rabies, for example.
Yeah, for example. And vertical is the opposite. So on a long term, in a vertical transmission system, the parasite is the most successful who managed to survive with his host. Yeah.
So it must be benign or whatever you call it.
And when we come to modern beekeeping situation, we do everything to support horizontal spread.
Yeah. We agree.
First of all, we have big apiaries where the most susceptible colony decides on the health status of maybe 49 neighbor countries, neighbor colonies within the same apiary. Yeah. So it's always the worst who decides about the situation of the whole group. And then with our treatment concept, we do the next important step to support horizontal transmission. Because if we successfully kill nearly all the mites in December, what happens the next season? Some mites remain in some of the hives and they spread very fast. But that means for the individual colonies, the mites which come in and propagate are not the ones which have been in there before. And once you understand these differences, you get a good basis to develop improved sustainable management concepts. So one basic demand should be, whatever you can, try to support vertical transmission and to reduce horizontal transmission. And there are several clear consequences. First of all, the main transition period is after the harvest, when we have strong colonies, where plenty of bees still go around searching for food, and they find then weak colonies which they can rob. So in August, September, we have the main mite spread, what we call reinvasion. This is the first thing we have to prevent. The way how we can prevent it, reduce mites load before. Keep your colonies healthy, that in this critical period of late summer period, we don't have this extreme spread of mites. There's another thing which sounds crazy in the first moment, but I think at the end it's wise. If you have colonies which survive well a full season with their mites, don't kill those mites.
Okay.
Protect them.
Yeah.
You can be happy that you have mites, parentheses open, including all the virus loads, parentheses closed.
Carry about mites.
Yeah. In your hive, which obviously the bees can do very well. So keep those mites.
Okay.
Don't kill them. Why do you kill mites in colonies where you don't need a treatment? But this is standard nowadays.
Yes.
How many beekeepers really check infestation? No, they all treat according to a certain routine. And they kill all the mites, the good ones and the bad ones.
Not like in other livestock population, for example, birds or cows. There are different methods, like intervention usually.
Yeah, but I'm not so sure. We have some crazy activities there as well. if you feed antibiotics to the whole stock, which sometimes happen and things like this, it's just the same.
But this is not good practice. Yeah.
No, it's not good practice. And what beekeepers are doing right now is not good practice. Sorry, sir.
Well, for me, I totally agree with this vertical and horizontal transmissions. I 100% agree. But I see the, let's call it, escape from this also in making the colonies, not only because we can't, even in the wild, there will be no zero horizontal transmission. There will always be some horizontal transmissions. Even if it's one colony per square kilometers, there will always be some transmission. So we cannot stop it fully, but we can't in this situation, but we could stop it if the colonies were somehow resistant. I'm seeing it's like, if we compare it to like the last pandemic, yeah, we heard all the time, and I fully agree with it. If we vaccinate, then we will be more resistant and we won't spread that much of disease. Yeah. So, for example, vaccinations would be making some organism more resistant that will at least slow down, if not stop, but at least slow down the horizontal transmission. So there are unfortunately no vaccinations for the bees. But we could propagate the resistance by resistance breeding. And if these bees are resistant, then horizontal transmissions would either be, well, it wouldn't be stopped, but it would be slowed down.
Yeah.
So even if we have lots of bees everywhere and we can't stop horizontal transmission by taking out the pest, we still can slow down the horizontal transmission by breeding. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
So that's why I'm always saying that we as beekeepers do absolutely too little to propagate resistant genetics.
Yes.
Okay. So I have an important question for me. Are you more in favor of instrumental insemination or natural mating in a conventional apiaries?
Instrumental insemination is a perfect technique to control the mating, and it plays an extremely important role in selection programs. So we really need this technique, but it makes only sense within a breeding program. And this doesn't make sense for commercial beekeeping to go with inseminated queens. For what reason? Yeah. Yeah.
And for like us, for example, for hobbies beekeeping.
I mean, if you are interested in breeding, it's a good idea to learn artificial insemination. I'm doing this myself. I mean, I test colonies and then I see interesting traits. And if I want to strengthen them in my population, I want to control the mating, of course. And that's artificial insemination then. But if you are not selecting, so let the nature select by open mating.
Okay,
yeah. We you know, in Poland, there are many, well, beekeepers, breeders that take pride that we have probably most artificial insemination in the whole Europe. And, you know, that's why we were interested in your opinion about this, because many beekeepers that are just amateurs and they are using these queens for production, but, you know, they've feel they are better because their breeding is controlled. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, in Germany, we have a slightly different system. There's quite a number of so-called mating stations. We have very well isolated mating stations on the islands and in valleys between high mountains in the south. So there you have a high reliability in the mating. But then we also have land mating stations where there are other bees around in 5, 6, 7 kilometer circles. So you won't achieve 80, 90, 100% security when you want to mate queens with certain drones, but still you have a strong selection. And I think this, you don't have these mating stations in Poland.
There are some, but I'm not sure how well organized are they.
Yeah.
But for sure there are some.
So for Germany, it plays an important role. And if I am a beekeeper and I see that my neighbor beekeepers import queens from Turkey, as you said, or have Ligustica bees or have mellifera bees or whatever, different breeding interests than myself, then my only chance is to take my queens and go to land mating station, which is perhaps close by, to get matings with Carnica or with Buckfast stones, just as I am interested in.
Yeah. Okay, so you have no problem with instrumental insemination to the breeding system?
There's no general problem with this. The question is if it makes sense. And it, as I said, so in, if you have a very mixed drone population around you, then it makes sense to have some selection, at least to be sure that you are within a certain race. And this can be achieved with artificial insemination. But I think it's a bit overdone because it's quite a lot of work. And usually I would say it fits very well in a breeding program, but not in a commercial.
So you don't have any problem with instrumental insemination, like even in mass production of breeding, mass production of bees, and you don't have any problems with natural mating in just conventional apiaries.
Yeah, I mean, artificial insemination is as good as it is carried out. First of all, it's just a technique. And the technique works and is extremely useful in breeding programs.
It's not a magical technique. Yeah.
But of course, you can make huge mistakes because then it's the inseminator who decides about the drones. Is there sufficient vitality? Is there sufficient variability within the drone population and all those things? You can easily achieve high inbreeding level with artificial insemination. And this, of course, can be disastrous. So there is a very high responsibility with the persons who carry out artificial insemination. And if you remain in the natural system, you are better protected against such mistakes. But given the fact that you have experienced and reliable people, then artificial insemination is fine. Yeah?
Yeah, okay. Thanks, sir, for your answer. I would like to change, if you mind.
Yeah, sure.
I would like to change the subject because there is a lot of discussion now, especially in the scientific world, about the negative impact of industrial mass beekeeping on the population of the white pollinators. Other bees too, yeah, other white bees, some of which are endangered of extinction. What do you thought about this? In Poland, there is a discussion about overpopulation of bees, honeybees, I mean, and the beekeeping industry of and those responsible for the coordinating and organized beekeeping at a strategic level still push to increase the population. Even as we speak, the stock is increasing, despite increased losses of colonies and crisis in beekeeping. What do you think about this? Maybe less is better, or no?
We have similar discussions in Germany, of course, and I mean, it's a serious discussion in any case. My personal position is the extremes are wrong. I mean, there are specific situations where you have rare pollinators which have to be protected in their natural environment. And if they compete with honeybees about pollen and nectar, then it can make sense to keep honeybees out or at least to reduce the numbers, to reduce the competition. But this is probably limited to very special spots. And you should know exactly which bees are here and to develop protection strategies for those bees as it's common in natural protection. You have to define what are your protection goals and then to develop a scientific strategy. What we see at the moment, this general discussion, we have too many honeybees and therefore we are losing wild pollinators, is just nonsense. It's absolutely nonsense. I mean, and honeybees in apiaries, it's a part of agriculture, as I said before. And we want to have honeybees as pollinators in certain crops. And we have keep honeybees to produce honey and to produce pollen. And this is okay. And beekeepers can increase the numbers of hives as long as the colonies are healthy. And if they harvest sufficient honey, so that shows that there are the resources. And I think in most spots, we could even have more honeybees as we have right now. At least in Germany, it's the case. We had 2.5 times more colonies in the early years after the Second World War. So the population went down very much, and we could increase it. So I'm pro honeybee keeping and
more than better, yeah.
It depends. As long as beekeepers can make a living or have fun on bees, it's fine.
But you don't have any problem with more.
No, it's not wrong. Any as I said, there will be some spots where it's wise to limit, to reduce, or even to exclude honeybees from ecosystems. But this is specific protection program for specific bees in special spots. So this is nature protection. And I don't know how much percent of our landscape may fall in this category. Probably it's less than 1%. For sure it's less than 10% of the landscape. And there's sufficient space in our cities and in our agricultural landscape to keep many, many honeybees.
Okay.
And beekeepers don't depend on these natural protection areas.
Okay.
Yeah.
I understand if you do. You have any...
Yeah, I mean, about... Because, you know, one thing is the... Let's call it competition for food, yeah? Mm. But the other thing is that there is more and more about this in media and in research about the transmissions of pathogens from honeybees to wild bees, solitary bees. Yeah, and what do you think about this problem? Because I see that I don't have any problem with beekeeping, especially beekeeping that you describe, yeah?
Mm.
Doing the selection or, you know, taking down the pressure of chemical substances and so on and so on. But as I see the industrial beekeeping, which is overusing the substances and which is making the pathogens very aggressive and viral, and if those pathogens find their way of transmitting to other species, there may be some problems of those bees. What do you think about this problem?
Yes, probably also this is a rare case. There are not so many pathogens which can easily switch from one species to another. But it can happen, and it's shown. And of course, you are right. This is another aspect beside this food competition, which demands careful handling of beekeeping in certain protection areas. But once again, if you come back to 90% of our landscape, we have forestry and then we have intensive farming. And the sizes of fields, for example, exclude many solitary bees from our landscape. So we really depend
more,
on
more problematic than, yeah, than honeybee, yeah, for sure.
And in this discussion, it's sometimes overseen that honeybees can also have a very positive effect on wild pollinators, because if you have a basic pollination guarantee by honeybees, rare plant species can keep their population even in periods where wild pollinators are missing. So we see this, and there are some studies, was one in Austria, for example, who could show that in spots where there is a long tradition in beekeeping, you find higher wild pollinator population than in areas where you don't have this traditional beekeeping. So at the end, I think the more important aspect is, can we improve our landscapes with regard of pollinators? And there are a lot of options in agriculture, but also in forestry, and last not least in private grounds, gardens, social grounds, where you can really improve the biodiversity and in blooming plants. Yeah,
yeah, I understand you, but some people think about honeybee also like a white or maybe feral animal too. And what do you think about, in Poland we have a few projects to bring honeybees into the forest and treat them like a feral or white bee?
Yeah, It's a nice idea, but conservationist
biologist of other white bee could say now that sorry that this is a natural environment.
Yeah, I think we more or less discussed this point already, because what happens at the moment where you bring colonies, honeybee colonies in a natural situation is that you will immediately have a much lower population. Yeah. And we don't have these areas. You already answered. There's no place in Poland where that could happen. And the same is in Germany. We don't have these areas. So what we observed, there was some research the last few years, is we always have swarms which escape and which sometimes do 2-3 years. But till now, we didn't find a stable, wild, feral honeybee population. I think it's really gone, and we shouldn't dream of this if we don't have these wide areas. And I always thought that in this northeastern part of Poland and then also into the Ukraine, there are some forest areas where probably you still have feral honeybee population.
Difficult to say. Near the Ukraine border, there is very high bee density.
Yeah.
Near Belarus border and Lithuanian border, there is much less bee density as this in apiaries. Yeah, we have no idea actually how much feral living colonies could be there. Yeah, but for sure there are more to the south. There is much higher bee density as farmed, let's call it. Okay.
And our in Poland and our native subspecies of honeybee has been almost destroyed.
Yeah. That's true. But again, I mean, don't oversee the point. The bees which we had here 50, 60, 70 years ago as the endemic honeybee subspecies would have changed quite a lot in the meantime, because the environment has changed so much.
Yes.
Yeah, there is a continuous adaptation to climate, to land use, and so it doesn't make sense to say, well, there was a bee 70 years ago. We should try to get this back. No, find bees which are well adapted to the given situation. So.
Okay. So you said that you are not a philosopher, but you are a scientist, but sorry. My point of view that every man have some point of view of the world. So maybe could I ask you a question? Could you, do you see honeybee like a species or as more of the white of domestic animal?
It's really something in between. And honeybees are still wild. Yeah. We can't train them like we train our dogs or like we select cattle, which is kept in stall buildings and artificially fed. And so it's different. Beekeeping depends on bees which can harvest in the wild and which can cope with all climatic challenges. So in that sense, it's wild. But of course, we keep our bees in boxes, in apiaries, mm-hmm. with a certain management program. They are not domesticated, but they are used. They are used wild animals.
But they are mass breeding. In the selection program, human selection program, yeah?
Yes, that's true. We change some traits which are of importance, yeah? So it's somewhere in between, really difficult to say it.
Yeah, that's why I will ask you this question.
Okay.
I like difficult questions. You know.
Is honey a plant or an animal product? This is, again, one of the very difficult questions, yeah, I know.
Both.
No, dalej.
Can I ask you more questions? Or you are tired, maybe? Okay, so next philosophical question. Could the Varroa destructor might be an admirable animal for you, maybe?
Oh, yes, sure. I already admired it in some of my talks, because I said, well, we learn so much from this parasite, and it's always the challenges which strengthens you. You see, it's if you come from an evolutionary point of view, you can say it's mainly the pests and parasites, which has driven evolution. So, yeah. So don't fear challenges. That's what I try to contribute to this morning's discussion. If we see all these threats, hornets, tropilelabs, climate change, landscape use, all those things, of course, beekeepers are worried. What happens? How can we react? But at the end, there are options to react. And all those challenges can strengthen the industry at the end. So I'm really optimistic in this. And clearly, looking back, the last 40 years of bee science on worldwide was driven mainly by varroa and the consequences. And we learned so much. And I made my living out of it. I mean, I couldn't have survived without varroa. Yes.
Okay. I've heard somewhere that before varroa era, money that came to bee science was like, I don't know, like let's call them peanuts, yeah? It was like $1 million for the whole United States or something, yeah? And now it's like probably even in billions. Maybe I overstated it, yeah?
No.
But it's so much more, yeah?
I don't know the numbers, but for sure it was a strong stimulus. It was, if I take the European level, a strong stimulus also to cooperate. So we had first this Polish-German bee conferences. So that started in 91. And it was the first time that bee scientists from East and West met and shared their visions and their experience. And from this time onward, we had regular conferences and close personal contacts. And now it's clear for everybody in this bee science, we cooperate, at least on a European level, but in many questions also on an international level. And this is also
okay,
forced by varroa.
Well, yeah, we talk about bee species, honeybee species. We talk about varroa destructor species. And now let's talk about human. I send you a part of the article you read probably, yeah? About parasocial unequal power relationship between the beekeeper and the bee, like a biopower relationship. What do you think about this? especially in the modern time in the industrial beekeeping and the evolution of the more and more and the better methods of the controlling of bees, of the controlling of this whole superorganism of the colony. Yeah,
I read it, but I don't remember it very well.
Maybe I'll somehow state few facts. It's about that we have the full control over living creature, and we somehow take the subjectivity of it. Yeah, we treat it as an object. And do you have any ethical issues with taking the animal into our power? Yeah, like having this power relation over the bee. Yeah, because we control the mate. Of course, we can't control it fully, yeah? But we control how it lives. We control how it reproduces. We control what things we take from the hive and so on.
This is the essence of biotechnical method, yeah?
Yeah. So what do you have? Do you think it is an ethical issue or you just accept it that we can control it like this?
Or you maybe accepted that this is agriculture and that things so on like this?
My personal feeling and recognition of the interaction with bees is that, of course, we have some ideas how to manage them and we influence them. But it's more important even to observe these natural behaviors. And when I go to my bees, I'm always surprised, and they react usually different to what I expected. And I mean, this is now a very personal perspective, and it's perhaps my Christian background that I still, for me, it's like a wonder. So to see how bees react, and I learned so much from bees about nature in general, and I have very deep respect. So it's both. I mean, I'm happy that I could work my lifetime scientifically with honeybees. And we did many studies and we killed many bees and we destructed many, many fruit combs and all those ugly things in the service of research. And at the same time, the respect on bees and on their own nature was always growing. So for me, it's part of this agricultural life in a classical sense. I think people who work with animals on a daily basis are the ones who have the best understanding and best respect. And for me, it's strange if we come to this industrial production where we just see what we can take out. So the reports which we have, and I had the chance to visit some beekeepers in United States. Mm-hmm. So on this very technical industrial production, this is strange. I would not like to be a beekeeper like this. And with 40,000 hives transported every few weeks to next and split. And if I lose 30%, no problem. I can propagate again. And so it's like in chicken industry. Would never be the way of beekeeping. And all the things we discussed before about this more sustainable and natural-like beekeeping goes in a completely different direction. Mm-hmm. It's, first of all, to better understand the biology and then to see how can we act with bees in the sense of beekeeping. So we want to take something out of it, but in a responsible way. And protecting their vitality and this. And so this is classical agricultural culture for me. And
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, but your border is, for example, industrial beekeeping in the style in the United States or in the Canada. I think all of us are against that, about this style of the beekeeping.
It doesn't look right. Yeah. I mean, I'm not taking out that they love bees, because for sure at least they claim they love bees, but when you look how they do it, it's somehow you then think, how does this love look like?
I mean, it's absolutely right. You always have to be self-critical as an individual, but also in a beekeeper community. So we should be critical and ask ourselves, is this really sensible and this is fine? Because there's always a risk that you get used to certain practices, which from a different point of view are questionable. So I think this is basic position which you could keep for yourself. So sit back at a moment and allow these critical questions to yourself and find out. But yeah. At the end, it's pleasure to work with bees and to learn from bees about nature and to be deeply impressed on a daily basis on how life can function in such a complex organism.
Sometimes we name about our style of the beekeeping like bee-friendly beekeeper, something like this.
That should be basic.
But some people wouldn't agree, that letting bees die is bee-friendly, So... So it's always very problematic and it's lots of discussion about.
But this is our philosophy.
Yeah, it's about philosophy. Yeah,
we have a right to do it. Like we are feel with the relation with bees, right? Like you said.
Yeah. In our training courses, I sometimes try to explain people the unit is the bee colony, and at the moment where we open a hive or where we change things inside the nest, it's like in orthopedy. So we open an organism and we start to manipulate it. So be careful. Be careful. It demands knowledge. You have to be very, very careful not to destroy things and be aware you are deeply within the organism. It's something different. If you keep a dog, it's always the dog beside you. You can't open it. You're not a doctor. But beekeepers are. We open our hives. Okay. We go in the middle, and that this is a unique chance. You can't have a deeper touch to life, a deeper insight in life processes than working with bees. That's the positive side. And the negative side is the risk to destroy something is much higher than in other animals. So this is how I see it and experience it. And
destroy something that could be beautiful.
Yes, sure. Yeah, it's beautiful in itself. And we have to protect
it. It's a pity to destroy this.
Yeah. But that's our human reality. We live with nature. We live from nature. I'm really agriculturist. I'm proud that I can make a living out of the use of natural processes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's good. And I always wanted that the option remains for young people to say, well, I will make a living as a beekeeper. That should be protected. It's a part of our culture.
Mm-hmm.
I see a high value in it. And that means, yes, you have to use it. You have to manipulate it. You have to manage it. But at the same time, to do it in a responsible way and with respect for the creature and for...
Maybe with the empathy of the superorganism.
Yes, yeah. This is a special point. This is the organism, the super organism we are acting with.
Okay.
Yeah, many options.
I would like before we finish, if we have time. I'm sorry.
I have to. Man, yeah.
Yeah. Because we talked for some time about treatment-free beekeeping, and you said you are critical about it. Let's call it. But what do you think about? Well, we've mentioned some time as well this. What do you think about the importance or dangers of free living, wild living populations? I mean, we mentioned it, but what do you think? What is the value of it in selection or the endangerment for the beekeeping? Or do you see it more of a chance or more of a danger?
No, I'm completely relaxed about this. I mean, we discussed before, we don't have these wide areas which would be needed if you really want to develop resistant populations or preserve certain genetic stock. So we don't have this. We have a much too high bee density in that sense. At the same time, there is no risk. Because if there are 10 free living colonies in hundreds of square kilometers, what shall they do? Of course, when they collapse, they have mites, they have viruses and can infest neighbor countries. But at the same time, we have hundreds of apiaries around. And as long as one of those 100 beekeepers fail in the treatment, the risk is much higher. So I'm completely relaxed.
Okay.
And it's interesting to follow from a biological point of view. It's always interesting to see how long can they survive and what is different in those colonies which live there somewhere in a building and in space on their natural combs with limited space and so on.
And you are against treatment for these feral bees?
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. I mean, they live in caves where you can't touch them and let them do. Don't worry about it.
And do you think we should help somehow building these feral populations, or we should do nothing in this case? Or, I mean, by swarming, by hanging tree hives, and so on. Do you think
and let old trees to grow to the old
with tree cavities? Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense for me as long as we don't have these wide areas which such colonies need to survive. So it's going hand in hand, and yeah.
So your point of view is very holistic, I think, that maybe in the future we can rebuild such a ecosystem, maybe part-wide ecosystem, maybe, who knows?
Yeah, if we have wide natural areas where we don't run agriculture, where we don't have settlements of humans and so on, but... I don't know.
Don't know future, of course.
Will, okay.
I mean, after we die, probably.
Yeah, I'm asking because, you know, in United Kingdom, which is completely different as far as beekeeping is, because they have very low bee density. It's probably lower than 2 colonies per square kilometer. Yeah. And in Poland, it's 7.5. I don't know how much is in Germany. Yeah. But in the United Kingdom, wild living or feral living colonies is, I don't know how much percentage, but obviously they are seen there. Yeah. They are there. Yeah. It's not like here. It's like, you know, you found one and wow, you found one. There are like beekeepers that know there are at least dozen or 20 or 30 wild living colonies. I know few beekeepers who claim they know more than 10 wild living colonies. So this population there for sure is part of the of all the bee colonies.
Genetic exchange.
Genetic exchange.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And in Poland, it's completely different. So I was wondering if by helping to build these wild living colonies, we could help in selection for ourselves. If we, for example, if we had, I don't know, 10% of all the colonies that would be wild living, would they help in our selection, or would they rather be the problem for us if there were too many of them? Because if there are a few, you said it's no problem. Yeah, you just laughed at it.
So I don't see a problem in any case. So never. And the best example probably is Brazil, South America, where we know 80-90% of the colonies are wild living and show us strong swarming behavior, and you always have quick adaptation to changing situations, new parasites, and so on. So this shows the model. I don't have too much detailed information on the situation in Britain, so it's difficult to estimate what is the effect if you have just 5% or 10% or 15% of the population wild living. But I agree, it might already have an effect. And for Poland, and definitely the same for Germany, I don't see the areas where this could develop. And on the opposite, I'm absolutely sure with our breeding techniques, with a good selection and arrangement in the beekeeping community, we can really speed up the selection in a...
Yeah, for sure. For sure, we can do it faster if we would start it. Yeah. Yeah.
So this is more important. This is the approach we can sensefully follow. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much, Ralph. Was great. I think it was a great discussion.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
And after half an hour, I think we have a great flow.
Yes, sure. I enjoyed it. You have good questions, interesting perspectives on the field, and hopefully beekeepers follow and get my ideas in the right way. So thank you for your interest.
yeah, let's hope it.
No problem. It's pleasure to me. Have a nice day and tomorrow in Krakow. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.